Welcome to the podcast. I'm Dr. Val Jones, founder of GetBetterHealth.com. Today we'll be speaking with Dr. Rahul Parikh about common misconceptions in pediatrics, or as I like to call it, Mythbusters for Moms. Rahul is a board-certified pediatrician who works at Kaiser Permanente's Walnut Creek Medical Center in California. Prior to becoming a pediatrician, Rahul completed a degree in molecular biology at UC Berkeley and his medical degree at Tufts in Boston. Online, Rahul is perhaps best known for his blog Vital Signs, featured at Salon.com. There he takes a critical look at media misinformation about health and science and has spoken out against misleading content promoted by Oprah Winfrey and the Huffington Post. So in the spirit of that critical thinking, I've asked Rahul to join us today. Rahul, I'm so glad you're here.
Hey, well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Let's begin with your thoughts on pediatric fevers. I have a feeling that parents have quite a few misconceptions about them. What concerns are you seeing in your practice?
Right. It's actually not just parents. It's actually physicians as well. And let me give you a brief history of where what we call fever phobia started. Back in 1876, a physician named Claude Bernard, who's French and probably considered the human of the father of human physiology, learned that fever kills when he experimented on some animals and raised their body temperatures above normal several degrees. And before that, fever was actually considered a natural part of being sick and getting over it, and even celebrated in some cultures as a way to for people to know that the body was fighting off infection. But Bernard's discovery began the march towards fever phobia, where parents and doctors became scared of fever. And then, of course, started prescribing drugs like Tylenol and Motrin to fight fever. It was about 20 or 30 years ago where a famous pediatrician named Barton Schmidt discovered just how far fever phobia had become, how far fever phobia had come along, when he did a study and found that 94% of parents believed that fever would cause serious harm, including permanent brain damage, and that parents actually believed that a child's temperature could rise over 110 degrees or higher, and that doing things like alternating Tylenol and Motrin to treat fever, using ice-cold water or alcohol to cool your child down were actually the correct things to do. So that was parents. And then it turns out physicians, when you survey them, also believe some of the very same myths about fever. Those are the concerns that I have, that parents and actually some doctors may actually believe that fevers are bad, where in actuality, they're okay. They're part of the body fighting infection, and the reason we give Tylenol or Motrin is not to cure the fever, but rather just to keep children comfortable.
So you would recommend using Tylenol and Motrin for the child's comfort?
Exactly. And not even in all cases, because there can be a child running around with a low grade temperature who may look just fine and feel comfortable and be very happy. If they seem uncomfortable, I recommend using it. But I don't recommend alternating the two, because I think that sets up the possibility of overdosing or misdosing your child, especially in the middle of the night if you can't remember what you've given your child.
Interesting. So you found that it's more likely that parents might accidentally give overdoses if they are trying to alternate versus just giving one or the other. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, there's a theoretical concern about it. There are some studies that suggest that maybe that the alternating does work, but the conventional wisdom is that we probably shouldn't advise parents to do that because of that risk. Because Tylenol overdoses often bring people into the emergency room more often than not.
Right. So I'm just wondering if people should just stick with Motrin then. What do you think? I mean, I guess each drug has its own risk profile.
Yeah, pick one. And as long as you're giving it in the right amount and the right dose, it'll be fine. And don't wake your child up in the middle of the night to take their temperature or give medication. That's probably making them more uncomfortable, and everyone's losing sleep more than you need to do.
Makes sense. So let's talk a little bit about teething. Do you think it's been used as a scapegoat for unexplained symptoms in kids?
Yes, and again, a little bit of medical history. In 19th century England, 5% of kids supposedly died of teething.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing we've cured that.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it? I mean, yeah, who would have thought? You know, and after that, for the past 110, 115 years, zero children have died from teething. So we have amazingly, as a result of our brilliance, cured teething. No, actually, teething is often used as a scapegoat, and again, by some physicians to, and there is a diagnosis that doctors can use called teething syndrome for a whole number of things, rashes on the face, diarrhea, fussiness, fevers even, again. And the studies generally have not shown that. Now, these aren't great studies, Al. I mean, they tend to be small numbers of studies, nothing that a doctor would look at and say, this is definitive. But there's enough sort of accumulative information to suggest that maybe that we should stop using teething as a diagnosis or an excuse for the symptoms, the vague symptoms children bring in. And certainly what I tell parents in my practice is whether or not you believe teething causes symptoms, fever is not due to teething ever, and don't let anyone tell you otherwise.
Hmm. You mentioned diarrhea in your list. I was like,
oh, yeah.
Wow. Are people saying that teething causes diarrhea?
Yeah, teething. I mean, it's amazing what you know, drooling. It goes on and on. I mean, it can be a whole number of things that that doctors and parents and tradition attributes to or blames teething for. we know better. And the bottom line is, though, you know, because the evidence is not strong, if a parent believes that their child is having teething symptoms, in my mind it's okay to use something like teething rings or you know, a little bit of ice or something for them to suck on a little bit, I guess, if they're a little older. I'm very clear that when it comes to fevers, teething is something they don't want to associate with it. They don't want to delay, you know, making sure that they're keeping an eye on their child and not blow off teething fever.
And what about food allergies? Is there some confusion about what they are exactly and how you can reduce the risk of developing them?
And with food allergies, there's a tremendous amount of new information coming out. And I started thinking about food allergies a couple of years ago in my practice when I began realizing that there are people from many different cultures, parents from many different cultures, introducing foods at many different ages. So, for example, I had a parent of children who wanted to introduce beef at a very young age, under one, and I used to think that was a no-no, but then I thought to myself, well, their cultural tradition is to do it, who am I to say no? And then over the years I've had parents of, I believe from Russia, were introducing applesauce at a young age and around 2 or 3 months, and a family from Japan who introduced a particular fruit juice under 6 months, and then I we started looking into it, and what I realized is that increasingly there's a growing body of evidence, including a study published this month in the journal Pediatrics, that suggests that it's okay to introduce food at a younger age. In fact, introducing food at a young age may actually make it less likely your child is going to get food allergies. And so the Academy of Pediatrics is actually increasingly moving in the direction of getting rid of the warning that parents should wait to introduce food.
And are parents having some confusion about what is a true food allergy as well, do you find?
Yeah, tremendous. I mean, for example, your child may eat some peanut butter and throw up and then suddenly realize that you may suddenly believe or be led to believe that your child has a food allergy to peanuts, and then they'll stop eating peanuts forever. When in reality, that could be something as simple as a child gagging on a very thick food and then just not being able to quite get it down their throat. And that happens often, and parents often misdiagnose food allergies because they're just not sure what an allergy is. And there's a great deal, particularly around peanuts, of sort of phobia around peanuts and peanut allergies that have been perpetuated. And I think they've got to be very careful about that. Certainly, if you're concerned your child has an allergy, they need to be treated and evaluated properly. Don't blow off any number of symptoms to allergies without consulting a physician.
So what sort of symptoms would you say are much more concerning and relevant to food allergies?
Certainly, if within a few minutes of eating a food, your child develops hives, for example, a very red, itchy rash all over the body, or complaints of some itching around the mouth or in the mouth, those may be signs of food allergies that need to be looked at more carefully. That's the most common kind of allergy that we often find with foods is our hives and those kinds of rashes. And, of course, we worry as doctors and parents who know whose children do have food allergies of what's called anaphylaxis, which is a very severe allergic reaction where not only do you get the hives, but you get swelling and trouble breathing, and it's usually a reason to call 911 right away. Or if you are a parent who's experienced, to use an epinephrine pen to give to your child.
And what about parents who themselves have food allergies? Let's say that they get an anaphylactic reaction to peanuts. Should they be, let's say they're planning to have a child, maybe the mom is pregnant. Is there a risk that their child will have that just genetically? And is that a high risk or is it rare? And how do parents prepare for the potentiality of their child having a severe food allergy to something that they do?
Right. And in my practice, I often get this question from parents who will say, I have an allergy to X food or even a medicine in some cases. Does that mean my child's going to have this allergy? And I say, absolutely not. And I don't do any advanced testing. I just educate parents on what to look out for if you and often they'll know because they've had the experience themselves what to look out for and let us know so we can start working it out between, you know, some testing on my end or having them see a specialist like an allergist.
So it's still pretty rare for a child to have the same reaction that the parent does, right?
Yes, yes. And it's not as clear-cut as, say, eye color or other things
right.
That your child is going to have a food allergy just like you do. Much
yep.
less clear-cut than that.
Yep. So I have saved the very best for last.
All right.
And I thought we would gently dip our toe into the common misconception that vaccines are bad, and for various reasons, I thought I'd let you perhaps describe to us, what you're seeing in your practice, what the common concerns and misconceptions are regarding vaccines in pediatrics in particular.
Vaccines have become a very emotional and polarizing issue, both in the community of pediatrics and among parents and in the media. The one thing that parents should always realize that vaccines are always have risks, and people should know about what those risks are. But autism and developmental problems that you hear about in the mainstream media, on Oprah, on Larry King, Jenny McCarthy, et cetera, is not one of those things. We have over 10 years now of science that proves that that's the case, that vaccines do not cause those things. The vaccine ingredients do not cause those things. And that vaccine schedule is appropriate and the best way to get your kids immunized against very dangerous diseases as soon as possible. And as pediatricians, we worry about the health of not only one child and one family, but the community as a whole. And our main concern is that as parents refuse vaccines because of what they hear, they often will not only put themselves at risk, they will be putting communities at risk. Because it's very easy. The world's very flat, as we all know, and all it takes is one plane ride somewhere to come in to your community, a passenger or someone to come in your community who has it and then spread a vaccine everywhere. And we've had that experience over the last few years in places like San Diego and Minnesota where vaccine-preventable diseases have broken out. Vaccines to me are the probably the greatest public health and greatest health thing that has happened in the last over 100 years. It saved the lives of more people and more children in particular than anyone else. And we've forgotten because of the success of vaccines just how good they are. And so there's an entire generation of us who've grown up without having seen these illnesses and how terrible they can be. But they're out there. All you have to do is travel somewhere in the world where people don't have health care as good as we have it here, and you'll see them, and they're very scary.
Absolutely. Well, they still have polio in India.
Yeah. Polio in India, they're trying very hard to eradicate it. I've seen in India where I've worked, I've seen polio, diphtheria, tetanus. I mean, just terrible, terrible things to see, and I wouldn't want to wish that on anyone. I'm hoping that that the efforts of pediatricians and communities and advocates for the health of children will overcome little by little the misconceptions about vaccines.
Now, you mentioned that there are some small risks with vaccines, though those risks do not include autism and developmental disorders. Can you let me know what are those actual risks and
sure.
how common are they?
They vary from vaccine to vaccine, but the most common vaccines for the vaccines children receive under one, the most common side effects are usually some pain at the site where a child gets the vaccine, which is usually in the legs, which is where they have the most muscle, and low grade fevers that don't usually last more than 24 to 48 hours, and there are very easy things you can do to comfort your child in those cases. You know, warm compresses over the thighs. There are actually some studies now that suggest giving your child a little bit of sugar water at the time they get the immunization can provide them with some distraction against the pain. And of course, you can give a little bit of Tylenol or, to help if they have a fever or seem uncomfortable afterwards. With certain vaccines like the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine or the chickenpox vaccine, there can be a rash associated with those vaccines that look very much like measles or chickenpox, but again, those rashes are not as severe, contagious, or dangerous, of course, as getting the actual illness itself. Some higher fevers with those vaccines. The tetanus vaccine and the HPV vaccine are both well known for the degree of sort of discomfort they cause in older kids, leaving the shoulders sore for a while. Those are the ones that most commonly occur, and I think what's important is that like in my practice, we make sure our parents are given a full outline of the possible vaccine side effects created by the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, and that they have time to ask us questions if they have concerns.
Well, when I get vaccines, I get a little bit of soreness in my arm, and I don't consider that too much of a risk. You're injecting a needle into a muscle.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, although I've had some kids, especially those teenagers, who sometimes get a little bit upset with the sore shoulder before baseball practice.
Oh, small risk there. But I just thought in closing, just to drive home the point about, how scary these preventable illnesses really are, and you said that you'd been in India and come face-to-face with them yourself. I wondered if you have a particular case in mind of one of these diseases that you saw and sort of just describe perhaps in what I might call gory detail, just so people will know what these things really look like. I mean, do you have a case that really surprised you? Go ahead. Let's hear what it was like.
When I went to India, I was a resident, and I was doing rounds with the residents in the teaching hospital there in Bombay. And as I was walking, as we were walking through, we came into one bed of a young mom who was with her son, who must have been, I don't know, I guess I remember 7, 8, 9 years old, and had tetanus. And what tetanus does is it makes your entire body, the muscles of your body, essentially get stiff, including the potential for the muscles of your respiratory system to get stiff. And that poor child was an absolute agony from not being able to move. He had a very characteristic appearance to his face, and for people who like Batman and know the Joker's smile, it looked like that. His muscles of his face were contracted upwards so that he had a very sort of had that sort of smile that doctors called risus sardonicus. And the mother, was just sitting by his bedside feeding him small drops of milk at a time because that's all he could take because he couldn't swallow because his mouth was unable to chew and swallow and those sorts of things. And it was just a scary thing. Now, that child was lucky he came through. But many, many don't because they just can't breathe or they just get sicker and sicker and die. And it's something that I still remember to this day vividly and often have a hard time communicating to families who are refusing vaccines around here because they haven't seen it.
Yeah, that's just terrifying. And it's kind of the irony of that child's, muscles in spasm causing him to have a smile when there was nothing to smile about,
it's a terrible, terrible thing to see, and I wouldn't wish on anyone, but these things do exist, and we need to be aware that it wouldn't be very hard for them to come back here if we were to let our guard down.
Well, thank goodness we can prevent them. So thank you so much.
Yes, thanks for having me. And, you know, it was a terrific chance to sit down with you finally. We've been talking off and on for the last few months.
We've been listening to a podcast interview with Rahul Parikh. I'm Dr. Val Jones, founder of GetBetterHealth.com.